Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. And this hour, we're in depth on why these sexual groping allegations and more sound so familiar.
The shameful comments about our bodies, the disrespect of our ambitions and intellect, the belief that you can do anything you want to a woman. It is cruel. It's frightening. And the truth is, it hurts. It hurts. It's like that sick, sinking feeling you get when you're walking down the street minding your own business and some guy yells out vulgar words about your body. Or when you see that guy at work that stands just a little too close, stares a little too long, and makes you feel uncomfortable in your own skin.
Michelle Obama verbalizing last week the anger and the shame and the pain that has simmered on social media since we heard Donald Trump on that Access Hollywood tape. When writer Kelly Oxford sent a tweet last Friday encouraging women to share an account of their first sexual assault, as many as 50 tweets per minute came back to her. By this morning, millions of people have responded. Today, a discussion about the sexually motivated assault, coercion, harassment, comments that women are exposed to from the time that we're young. And I'll share this. When I was put on morning drive as a newscaster at my first media market radio job, I thought I'd earned it as the best newscaster in the newsroom. What I soon discovered was that I was really there to play along with the sexual innuendo spewed out by the aging, grizzled morning drive host. I was the first woman newscaster that he'd had, and they wanted sexual chemistry. Long story short, when I refused to play along, I was given a stern talking to from the general manager, and I was taken off morning drive. Now, I told a lot of people about how unfair I thought it was. Nothing changed, but I still remember it. And of course, I know this is a mild example of the kind of harassment and assault and coercion and comments that women have been subjected to. But it also makes the point that most women have an experience that was unwanted, embarrassing, or outright illegal. So, as women, do you have an experience of unwanted touching, coercion, harassment, comments, assault? As mothers and fathers, what are you telling your daughters and sons about this? That's how we're framing the show this morning. I'd love to have you weigh in. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. Online at nprnews.org/live. On Twitter at CarrieNPR. I want to know, as women, if you have an experience, maybe something mild like the one I described, maybe all the way up to assault, somewhere in between. And as mothers and fathers, what are you telling your daughters and sons about this? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. I'm on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Kimberly Crenshaw teaches at Columbia Law School and UCLA Law School, where she specializes in gender and social justice issues. And she's with us today from LA. And Kimberly, welcome back to the show. It's really good to have you here.
It's great to be back, Carrie. Thank you.
Jacqueline Friedman is with us. She's an activist and the author of Yes Means Yes, and she's with us today from Boston. And Jacqueline, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Really pleased to be here.
Kimberly, I thought the New York Times put this well last week when it said that the result of this Trump tape and then what's happened with women coming out about this has been, quote, a kind of collective nationwide purge of painful, often long buried memories. Now, a couple of things about that. Why do you think the Trump tape triggered such a response? And how much of this do you think was his reaction and kind of non-apology apology? How responsible is that for the onslaught as well?
Well, I would say it was both things. And then one more I'd add to the list. I think I was one of millions of women who watched the debate waiting for this moment of confrontation, of stating that, to say that these comments were simply locker room talk, and to think that that is a defense is illustration of precisely the rape culture that produces the behavior that we've all experienced and are concerned about. And I think that there was just this, you know, when is it going to be said? When is he going to be directly confronted? And for many reasons that I think we all know, that didn't happen during the debate. But when the First Lady put words to the experience, the outrage, the everyday way in which we are made to feel less than, and the everyday way in which our sexuality has been taken and mobilized for other purposes. I think when she said that, that just was the capstone of this sort of overwhelming moment of finally I can acknowledge and see that what happened to me is not just about me. It's about a condition that impacts the lives of millions of women and girls across the country. And I think those three things together are making this something more than just a campaign issue.
Jacqueline, what Kimberly just said about the everyday way, that's the thing I think that has probably surprised some of us, that I think the thing is, you know, you might tell a good friend, depending on what has happened to you, and you might tell your family or a partner, and then for the most part, we go on and kind of live our lives. And what we discover when we start to compare notes is a lot of us have been through this, and it is indeed an everyday thing. Maybe that's the revelation here for me.
Oh, absolutely. It's an everyday thing. It's an everyday thing if you ask 14-year-old girls, right, that boys are grabbing and groping them in school and the school is looking the other way, right? And they think it's normal. I was literally writing an essay about the implications of Trump saying it was locker room talk. I was on a flight home from a talk I was giving last weekend. And the guy next to me on the plane offered me some Tic Tacs. Really, I'm not making that up. And when I turned him down, he said, "Oh, don't worry. Only a couple of them are roofies, so you're probably okay."
Yeah.
And when I objected, he was like, "Oh, you're not very friendly." You know, he got very belligerent. And that's just like, you know, it could happen to any of us any day, right? And I think the thing I want to say about this is, this isn't actually the first time we've had this conversation. I think maybe it's the most high profile in recent memory because it involves someone who is extraordinarily close to the presidency, shockingly close to the presidency. But, you know, earlier this year, it was Brock Turner, right? Like last year, it was somebody else, you know. We have these sort of spleenings and then the nation forgets and we go back to business as usual.
Let me take a call here from Amanda in St. Paul. Hi, Amanda. I'm glad you called. Tell me what your story is here. Hey, Amanda. Hi. Are you there? We might have lost her. Let's go to Nancy in St. Paul. Hey, Nancy, thanks so much for calling. What did you want to tell us? Oh, we might be having some phone problems here. Let me put the number out again. Let's see if we can fix that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. As I ask, as a woman, whether you have an experience of unwanted touching, coercion, harassment, assault, commentary, the interaction that Jacqueline just told us about, you know, on a plane coming home when this is a high profile event. As mothers and fathers, I want to know how you're talking about this as well to your daughters and sons. We're working on the phones. Keep calling 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, off of Twitter at Carrie NPR. Steph, off the page. We know that's working. What are we hearing?
Someone going by the name Older Lawyer now says, "I'm a lawyer and there are so many. The older partner who grabbed me and kissed me in an elevator. The partner who told me it was a good thing they hired me because they needed a nice pair of legs in the department."
Yeah?
Yeah.
In law firm. I'm actually hearing from some other lawyers on Twitter who were saying, Kimberly, I don't really know what to make of that. I noticed that there was a hashtag that accompanied a number of these tweets about sexually predatory attention over the weekend, hashtag not okay. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an acknowledgement that there are some people who think that grabbing at women or kissing them when they don't want it is not a very big deal. I mean, the fact that we have to hashtag not okay says something to me about where the culture is on this.
Absolutely. I mean, and, you know, I think what is so moving about the question, what are you telling your daughters, is the recognition that this starts very young. This isn't something that just happens when people get to high school or even college. When I was last on your show, I was talking about a Black Girls Matter report, and one piece of that we uncovered was how much sexual harassment goes on in school for young girls, and how often that is a factor that leads to girls either being suspended because they fight back, or sometimes even asked to leave. We talked to one parent who reported that his daughter was consistently harassed by a particular boy, including unwanted touching in exactly the way that Trump described. And when parents encounter teachers and say, what are you doing about it? They produce the same kind of rationale. Boys will be boys. Perhaps the best thing that you should do for your daughter is to take her out of school because obviously she's distracting the boys. So once again, you have in the earliest moments of a child's interaction with institutions, the recognition that her body and her sexuality is there for the boys to either grab onto or to be distracted by, but she's the problem, not their behavior. That's rape culture from the earliest moments of socialization.
Anne says on Twitter, and she's a physician, harassment based on my gender, ha, I'd need my own show just for the stories from the emergency department, sexual and otherwise. Melissa says this is why feminism still exists and why we need to have this conversation. And maybe women who say they don't identify with feminists will now. Let's try the phones here again to Amanda. Hi, Amanda. Are you there?
Good morning.
Oh,
FAM.
Good. Yay. Glad they're working because I really want to hear from people on this. Tell me about your story, your situation.
I shop at a local grocery store here in town, and I had been having conversations with one of the men that work there because I'm just friendly and I talk. And one day went to check out, and he, went to hand me a piece of candy like they do sometimes at the checkout, grabbed me, kissed me, and almost got me in the mouth. I was incredibly shocked and stunned and then thought, oh, gosh, I've been over-friendly to this person. Wouldn't go to the grocery store. I finally went in and spoke with the manager. I was told I was probably not the first person this has happened to, that they had talked with this gentleman before. He still works there. And, you know, I have a 17-year-old daughter, and I have talked to her endlessly about people getting into her space, that she, you know, has every right to tell people no. But I'm terrified of her going off to college, just terrified, because that was the reaction I got from a manager of a grocery store telling me that, oh, this has probably happened before, and then nothing happens to this man. And I go in there and feel incredibly uncomfortable now, or I have to figure out the hours that he's not going to be there to be able to go in.
Or take your business elsewhere, unhappily, but maybe take your business elsewhere.
But I have gone to other grocery stores, and there's another one I go to with a gentleman who's from another country, and I've seen he's had advances, you know, oh, I love seeing you, and, you know, pumping his heart, and you're so beautiful today. And I've been told, well, you know, it's probably because he's from another culture. So it goes on wherever you go. And as a woman, you feel like if you're going to have a conversation with somebody or be extra friendly, then that gives them a full invitation to come on and hug you and tell you how beautiful you are, or, you know, how happy I am to see you today. And it's just really uncomfortable. And I feel myself as a 53-year-old woman, if I feel that way, how is my 17-year-old daughter going to be strong enough to speak up? And she's had older men look at her. And I'll tell you, that's another thing, too, where I will be out and I will notice them looking at her. And I want to turn to them and say, she is 17 years old. I mean, it is a huge problem. And have any hope for it going away.
Yeah. You know, Amanda, what you're saying, what you're describing, Kimberly, I think what you said about the was it what grade level was it? The daughter in the grade?
It was an elementary school.
Okay. I don't think there's much difference between, as in, You come into our grocery store and we can't be responsible for the way men are going to react if you're walking around this grocery store. I don't see that there's all that much difference in the reaction to the way men and boys behave.
And society permits that. I mean, that is the problem. It's both the fact that there's no age barrier to being seen as a sexual
right.
object. We know that. And then there's no sanction for the seeing of it. I mean, one of the things I guess that is most surprising about the reaction to the what was filmed, Trump saying, was that he'd said equally obnoxious, outrageous things about girls, about children. So the idea that there is some that people will say, "Oh, sorry, she's 17, I didn't know." That is exactly the opposite. Right? Being 17 to a certain sort of perspective on this is exactly the target population that receives a lot of this unwanted sexual attention. That's been normalized across our culture, not just from Trump, but how our commercials, what kind of young ladies are asked to model, the way in which they're presented as sexual objects. This is why it's part of rape culture, not just a few bad apples.
Jacqueline, I was reading something that you wrote in March about your own experience with sexual assault, and you said that there is an impulse among women to deny the assault or some kind of unwanted attention because we don't want to think of ourselves as victims. You know, that really rang true to me. What else would you say to that?
You know, it's because being a victim is so stigmatized.
Right.
And I actually read a really fantastic book about called The Beginning and End of Rape by Sarah Deer, who is actually, she teaches in Minnesota.
Yes, she does.
That's right.
She's a MacArthur Genius Award winner. She does a lot of work on Native rights. And she wrote in that book a lot of – it's a great book. But there's a story in it about a Native tribe before the white invasion who revered survivors of sexual violence as being extraordinarily strong and having learned things and having insights that other people don't have. And so that click moment I had when I read that was like, oh, the way we stigmatize victims in this culture is not inherent. It's not natural. We could have a completely different attitude about rape victims. One of the things I heard in that caller's story is that constant and immediate impulse to self-blame. What did I do? I must have let him on.
Exactly.
It must be something I did. And we're hearing that conflation of women's sexuality and women's sexual appeal with an excuse for sexual violence in the sort of Trump surrogate's defense, too. You know, you hear people saying, somebody went on CNN and said, oh, well, Hillary likes Beyonce, and Beyonce has this racy sexual lyric. How is that any different than what Trump said? Well, the difference is consent, right? The difference is that Beyonce is singing about sex and sexuality that she wants and she owns, and Trump is talking about owning other people's bodies, right, and acting upon them without consent. And the fact that that's made invisible, that the idea is so common that if men feel sexual desire, they can't help themselves, right, that they're sexually incontinent and that we make excuses for them, therefore. Well, I mean, honestly, I think better of men. Men actually can control themselves.
I think
most men do.
Jacqueline, I think most of us would say, most women would say, we disavow that idea, but I think there's so many different ways that we've taken it in, right?
Oh, yeah.
I don't think it's something we want to believe that we believe, but boy, I really hear you when you say that.
And it's, you know, statistics, if you look at the research, it's just not true. If you talk to rapists, they don't say, oh, I picked her out because she was the sexiest.
Right.
And I was so turned on. They say, I picked her out because I thought she wouldn't protest. Right. I picked her out because I thought I could get away with it. It's absolutely an act of power. There's no basis in thinking that this is an act that's driven by overwhelming sexual desire that can't be controlled. But that idea is so deeply embedded in our culture because we have this very old, very deeply embedded sexual model about men being the pursuers, right? Men pursue sex. They take sex where they can. Women, we're not supposed to want sex on our own terms, which is why we get blamed for any male sexual violence if we've been sexual at all, right? We're supposed to resist or maybe reluctantly allow. And, you know, obviously that's bunk, right? We all have our own different sexual desires and boundaries. But that idea is so deeply embedded in so many of our cultural assumptions that it continues to pop up. It's like playing whack-a-mole.
Kimberly, I think that's why women hesitate to talk more openly about their own sexuality in a way, in kind of the way that Jacqueline just framed it, because I think always pushing back on that is this sense of, you think you own it, you don't own it completely. I own a part of that too, you know, in the culture. You know what I'm saying?
It's deeply embedded in the culture, and I think the confusion too between sexuality, sexual desire, and power is also bound up. We see it even in the response of the Trump surrogates and Trump himself to some of the women who've come forward by basically saying, "Well, look at her. How is this even possible?"
Right.
Well, we all know how it's possible, right? But we also know that because the culture is confused about what sexual abuse is about, that is a reasonable defense, which in turn makes a lot of women, number one, very uncomfortable about expressing their sexuality because they know that it can often be used. I mean, at one time, the law actually permitted defense attorneys to draw a connection between having had sex to the likelihood that the woman is telling the truth. I mean, there's a close association in our society between expressions of sexuality and veracity, but only for women. So we're aware of it. I mean, we learn from the time that we're girls what kind of behaviors make us most vulnerable, what happens when we say certain things happen to us, and consequently that means that we're shocked when we find out how many women this has happened to, because generally it's not discussed in public as a social issue in the way it has been over the last couple of weeks.
Kimberly Crenshaw with us if you've just tuned into the conversation. With us from UCLA, Jacqueline Friedman with us. She's the author of Yes Means Yes. And a discussion that follows on, I guess, a week last week in a presidential campaign, the likes of which I don't think we've ever seen. We'll talk to the political junkie about that, by the way, at the top of the 10 o'clock show. But what is happening via social media and in one-on-one and group conversations around women, among women, to talk about these incidences of unwanted sexual attention, all the way from, you know, commentary to coercion, to harassment, to sexual assault. And what's happening here as women realize that you have a story, you have a story, you have a story, and what's being discussed as we share those stories? I'm asking you this morning, if you have an experience with this, what are you talking to? And I think this is an important element of this. What are you saying to your sons and daughters about how this conversation is going and, you know, what kind of a culture they're either going to school in or they're going to college in? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, online at nprnews.org/live, and on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. Here's Nancy, who says, when I was at the U of M as a journalism major, I needed a signature on a class schedule from an advisor. He locked the door and said that women have no place in journalism, told her that she needed to take a law class, and then asked her what she thought about porn. Steph, off the page.
Someone going by, 45-year-old in Minneapolis, says, I was sexually abused when I was 8 years old, groped, French kissed, etc. I was able to move past this. But I think the sad part is the future relationships I had with adult men in my life. I had a terrific stepdad come into my life at the same time, and I always put up a barrier with him. I acted like I needed to protect myself from him, even though he was the most appropriate dad person he could be. I missed out on having a close relationship with a great parent in my life.
Melanie says on Twitter, so many times being groped in the subway in New York City in my 20s didn't occur to me till recently that that was assault. It was normal. To Heather in Minneapolis. Hi, Heather. What have you experienced with this?
Well, you know, I actually went to graduate school up in Moorhead, and I lived in Fargo for about a decade. And I lived right downtown. I was walking home one night, and a man approached me and introduced himself to me by name, told me that he worked in the neighborhood, told me specifically where he worked. And then he actually grabbed me by the shoulders and pulled my shirt off of me and told me to show him my breasts.
Mm-hmm.
And
this sounds really scary, Heather.
It was terrifying. I mean, I'm pretty small. I'm only 5'5", and he was a very large man. And I ended up calling the police. I ran home, locked my door, called the police, and an officer came out the next morning and put me in the back of his cop car, listened to my statement, and said that it sounded like something, that he was just being mischievous and that I should actually go directly to him and try and work things out with him.
What?
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't take a report?
Would not take a report, did not write a report. And after that, I called a women's crisis center and was told that I should definitely call the police again. And I had this man's name, his first name and his place of employment. And so I called again and I said, I really want to make a report. I feel like I was attacked last night. And so a different officer came out and this time came into my home, took my statement from my kitchen table.
Mm-hmm.
And said that he would be in touch with me. And ultimately, about 5 months later, I was called to court to testify against this man who had two previous felony assault charges.
Wow.
Yep. And so in North Dakota, I was told that a man can't be charged with sexual assault unless you can prove sexual gratification.
Mm-hmm.
And so this man was charged with a misdemeanor disturbing the peace. And because of his previous convictions and because I testified against him, he ended up getting 90 days in jail and a $1,500 fine.
I am so proud of you for pursuing that, though. I mean, as I said at the beginning of the show, I think a lot of women tell a friend, tell a partner, and just go, that's how it is. Good for you.
Right.
Good
Thank
for you.
You.
Kimberly, are the laws keeping up with, that may be an example of no, but are the laws keeping mm-hmm. up with what's going on in this?
Yeah, I mean, that your caller put her finger on it. For some period of time, as I mentioned, the law was just falling far behind the evolving consciousness, at least of women. There was a time when, in order to even prove sexual assault, you had to prove that the woman resisted and her resistance was overcome. So basically, it made everything up to the moment of overcoming a woman's resistance perfectly legal, which is, again, part of the cultural idea that sex is something that men procure. They're encouraged to go out and be aggressive up to a point. That is somewhat fallen by the wayside, at least formally, but a lot of juries still have the idea that unless you fought back, it's not really sexual assault. And the same occurs with the sexual touching. Many states have had the idea that it has to be done for sexual gratification. So again, it collapses sexual gratification into sexual power. It's not really illegitimate unless you can show that this is the reason why he did it. I think now we have more laws across the country that say unwanted touching for whatever purposes is subject to assault, and unwanted touching of genitalia is in fact comes under sexual assault law. So in all of the states, in New York and in Florida, where this has, where some of the women who've come forward saying that Trump touched them in this way, they are actually describing assaults,
right.
Assaults by law.
Jacqueline, would you say something on this?
Well, what I would add to that is it's not just about whether the laws are in place, because I absolutely agree that these are legally sexual assaults that are being described, but also whether, as we heard in the caller story, whether the police are going to apply those laws. We saw an enormous leak of internal police documents from the Baltimore Police Department come out in the past year, and Katie Jam Baker and some other folks at BuzzFeed did really important story going through them, seeing how they handle the cases of sexual assault, and they found constant instances of police just blowing off victim reports, calling them horrible names I don't want to repeat on the radio, you know, slut-shaming them, and in general not taking female victims of assault seriously when they come to the police. So you can have a great law on the books, but if the police who you're reporting to, as we heard, don't take you seriously, I mean, most victims aren't going to be as strong as that caller to sort of
That's
go
right.
back a second time.
Exactly.
It's you know, most victims don't go to the police at all because, A, they don't trust that they'll be believed. And also, you know, in a number of communities, as we've seen, there's not a trust with the police to begin with. The police aren't seen as an ally. And sometimes it's the police who are doing the assaulting. Who do you report
That's right.
to then?
Mm-hmm. A call here from Mercedes in Minneapolis. Hi, Mercedes. Thanks so much for waiting.
Thank you.
Tell me about your story, your situation.
Hi, I was in law. I was a student in law school, a first year student, and one of my law school colleagues groped me at a party, mm-hmm. Completely unprovoked, and he knew that I had a boyfriend, and so when he grabbed me, I pushed him away and I yelled, and then he called me a really offensive name. And I had gone to the party with a couple of really good friends of mine who were also men. And I went and told them what happened because I was really upset. And while they acknowledged that what I experienced was, you know, was not acceptable, they really tried to kind of downplay the villainous mm-hmm. act that this guy had done to me. And so not only did it completely impact my experience at the school because it had been a safe space. And after that, it wasn't really, but it also like kind of impacted my relationship with my classmates because they were okay with this guy and I didn't want to be anywhere near him.
Mercedes, you've brought up something I really want to talk about here. And that is the way not only power gets wielded by the person who's, you know, perpetrating this sexually unwanted behavior, but then how the rest of the friends, the culture, the community treats it. I mean, you see some of the reaction here. You see some of what Donald Trump is saying about this, and then you see some of the reaction from, I don't know, Rudy Giuliani and other supporters of his who are raising comments about, oh, is this to be believed? Look at her, those kinds of things. So Kimberly Crenshaw is with us. She teaches at Columbia Law School in UCLA, and Jacqueline Friedman is with us. She's the author of Yes Means Yes, and a discussion, if you've just gotten in on this, on the conversation that started between one-on-one among women, among groups of women in our community, in our culture, at the highest level, about the kind of sexual harassment and unwanted attention and touching and assault and commentary that women have been subjected to for a long time, and why it took this incident with Donald Trump to bring it out, I don't know. We've commented on that at the beginning of the show, but it's good that this discussion is going on. So bringing my best and my guests back into the discussion here and going to a call to Heather in Plymouth. Hi, Heather. Thanks so much for waiting.
Thanks, Carrie. I just wanted to share that in kind of first hearing your question, I didn't even think in my head that I had ever been sexually assaulted. And then kind of hearing some stories, mm-hmm. I realized back when I was a sophomore in high school, I was in theater and we were backstage and one of my fellow students just grabbed my breasts completely like out of the blue and kind of realized that that's in fact what that is. And I didn't report it. I didn't tell my parents. I didn't tell any friends. I didn't really think that much of it because that was kind of the culture that had been set up backstage. And it was something that just was what it was.
What did you say to the person who did it, though, at the time?
Yeah, I think I slapped his hands away, and I was like, hell no.
Yeah.
But kind of just, you know, then marched on stage and went about the rest of my day.
Right. Yeah, I'm glad for the call. Kimberly and Jacqueline, this brings me back to kind of this power dynamic. I mean, I think we're seeing entitlement in what Trump, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. what we heard in the tape and what we're hearing from these other women. But I also think he's not the only one that feels that kind of power dynamic.
Right.
Kimberly, will you say it's like a toxic masculinity or something going on?
It is. And to be honest, Carrie, I would be remiss if I didn't point out that we're not just talking about a rape culture when we're talking about this, particularly given Trump's own history. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a racist rape culture, and let me say why this is important to all women. You know, one thing that happened the week before last, right before the videotape came out, was Donald Trump doubled down on something he'd done in the 90s when he called for the death penalty for the Central Park Five. They were young African-American and Latino men who were falsely accused, as it turns out, of raping the Central Park jogger. It's long been proved that they were innocent, but he continues to hold that, A, they were guilty, B, that the death penalty was appropriate, and C, that any settlement was inappropriate. Now, why does that matter in this conversation? This is part of a long history of sexual predation on the part of powerful men being projected onto other men. This, you remember, this is kind of a theme for Donald Trump. Mexicans are rapists. Central Park Five are rapists. What you find many times is that the way in which sexual abuse and sexual assault that's intraracial is normalized is by saying, well, look, at least it's not a black man doing it. Or, you know, the true sexual assault that we have to concern ourselves with are people who live somewhere else.
Right.
In reality, sexual abuse, sexual assault is dramatically intraracial. And in reality, many of the same people who are the first to lead the lynch mob, are the first to call for the death penalty, are precisely the ones who are engaging in exactly this kind of behavior. So it's in the interest of women to reject not just the rape culture part of it, but the part that says what happens to me is only important if it's done by someone who doesn't look like me. Mm-hmm. And that's a way of normalizing sexual abuse as well.
Jacqueline, I want you to hear something that we had a conversation with about how gender has played out in the election. And Susan Chira from the New York Times was one of our guests, and she writes about gender. And she talks about this exaggerated sense of masculinity that Trump projects and why there are some Americans who really respond to that. So we pulled a little soundbite here, and I want you to hear this.
He's kind of an exaggeration of conventional American masculinity, if you will. He's larger than life in so many ways, and the way that he has used a kind of hyper-masculinity in this election, you know, if guys talk about girls, Donald Trump's going to talk about women in a way that you've seldom been allowed to listen in on unless you yourself have been the target of sexual harassment, as so many women have written in to say they've been.
Jacqueline, what do you hear in that?
Oh, absolutely. He is the apotheosis of toxic masculinity in this culture, which is a concept of masculinity that defines itself as power over women, power over people who are more vulnerable, almost always defined as women or people who are feminine. And that is, it's a very dangerous conception of masculinity that suffuses the culture and also creates a fear of identification with women, right? So one of the things that I think would be make a profound change, and I'm so glad that when you've been asking this question, you've said, what are you saying to your sons and daughters, right? Because we need to be talking about sons about this as well. You know, we need to raise kids with girls' stories, right? Girls are asked all the time to identify with boy stories.
That's right.
But boys are assumed to not be able to identify with girl stories. We saw this last year when the Star Wars movie came out, and the toy manufacturers didn't make toys of the lead character, by and large, because she's female, and they expect that their market is boy. We need to raise boys who are expected to identify with strong women so that they grow up thinking about women as full, complex, equal human beings. Instead, we raise boys who are expected to see girls as fragile and less than, and to define their masculinity as stronger and more powerful than women. And we need desperately to create a new idea of masculinity in our culture, which doesn't rely on power over women to justify itself.
Steph, off the page.
Robin says, I work at a major health insurance company in the state, one that prides itself on progressivism. I reported a man who asked me to join his tantric yoga practice and constantly commented on my body. report to the HR department resulted in me being punished by having to move my desk and being made to feel like I was at fault for not assuming his best intentions. I was actually told by a supervisor, he's up for promotion. He could not get it based on this.
So it sounds like she kind of succumbed to this, right? Yeah. Moved her desk and...
And got shuffled over to the side. Yeah.
Somebody needs to report on HR there. To the phones to Jacob in Minneapolis. Hi, Jacob. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Thank you so much for having this conversation. It's really incredible. And I just wanted to talk for a second about men's responsibility
in
fighting against sexual violence. And I think it's our responsibility to teach our sons how to be good, decent, respectful people, and to kind of like create a new idea of masculinity, like Jacqueline was just talking about. It's our responsibility to listen to and hear women when they bring up these issues, and not go through this like knee jerk reaction of delegitimizing the stories that we hear, because they're constant and real. And I just think that so much of, you know, men are the primary actors in this stuff, and they hold the responsibility to hold each other accountable and to end and change this culture of rape violence, and to, you know, recreate a new idea of masculinity that's based on respect.
Jacob, I'm really glad you brought up that phrase, delegitimizing the stories, because Kimberly, have we seen anything but that with the way Donald Trump has treated these allegations? That's exactly what he's been doing on the campaign trail day to day.
Yes, with all of the tropes that we've known, I think the question, and this is something Jacqueline said earlier, we've been here before, we've seen this. I mean, there's nothing that happened that isn't out of the playbook of how to defend sexual abusers. I mean, we know this, from blaming the victim to undermining their credibility, to discussing their behavior, to discussing how they look. The fact that this can be framed as this is just locker room and this is how we respond as a defense is, exhibit A in terms of how much our culture generates precisely the problem. We're doing it, and we don't even realize that we're doing it. So I think the conversation that we're having now about how to encourage men to have this conversation might be a new wrinkle in this that will stop the cycle of this just coming up, going away. It comes up again in the same kind of way. There really is a tremendous conversation that is happening and needs to happen more broadly among men about precisely these questions.
Kimberly, always grateful when you have time to chat with us. Thank you so much for joining this discussion. Jacqueline, one word on what Kimberly said, if you will, about what happens, you know, the election's in 3 weeks. Is Kimberly right that this kind of, you know, diminishes and until the next time that we need to talk about it? Has anything really changed?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. I think we can decide to make this a moment of change. I certainly think we can rebuke this behavior at the ballot box. But beyond that, I think the work is up to men to a large part. A lot of women have been doing this work for a long time. We need men to take this moment to stand up and make a change.
Really good to have you too as well. Thank you so much, Jacqueline. Really, I hope you'll come back to
Absolutely.
Continue the conversation with us. Good. Steph Curtis, off the page. I'm having a hard time keeping up with all the Twitter comments here. I'm hoping you're doing a better job.
Catherine says, conversations such as this about sexual assault and women is why I continue to be a sustaining member. I plan to share this conversation with my 16-year-old daughter and 14 and 13-year-old sons. Thank you, NPR and Carrie Miller, for such high-quality, relevant conversations.
I have to say, I think this discussion, I'd like to zero in for another conversation, again, specifically on what you say to to the daughter that's going off to college, or to the son who's 13 and in middle school or high school or middle school at that point.
Middle school.
Yeah. Where they're starting to become aware, right, of kind of sexual culture. Yeah. So I think we could zero in on that conversation
as well.
And one
parent wrote in, Heather, on here, and she said that she's got really little kids, but they have a stop means stop rule in their house because kids always like to push it. If someone's tickling somebody else. They like to keep going. If they're wrestling or chasing, they keep going. And she says, I think that she says, I'm laying the groundwork now. If someone's not enjoying something and they say, stop, you just stop right now. And she feels like she's laying the groundwork for them being empathetic, older children who listen to what other people are saying and thinking and feeling.
Laura Ann, teaching my 4 and 8-year-old consent by allowing them to be in control of who touches them, no hugs or kisses.
Yeah.
Without permission. Thank you very much for trusting us enough, trusting Steph and I this morning to call in and write in with mm-hmm. your stories and your accounts of what has happened. I don't think the show would have been what it was, which for me was pretty meaningful in sharing some accounts and hearing our expert guests weigh in on that. And there is something empowering about being able to open the phone lines and open our social media channels and say, I hope you feel secure enough. I hope you feel empowered enough to call in and share the story, because it is important to talk about it among ourselves. And I think you've demonstrated that.
Yes,